A Buried and a Burning Flame, written by Rexheim, and read by Wilfriede0815. Fandom, The Locked Tomb, relationship, Gideon Nav / Coronabeth Tridentarius. Rating, explicit. Archive warnings for major character death and rape non-con. From the additional tags, necrophilia, corpse desecration, Gideon Nav's yummy dead body. Dead dove, do not eat. The Ninth House Cavalier is as lovely in death as she was in life. Lovelier, even, because she's finally free of that god-awful face paint and scrubbed clean of paint and dirt and blood. More than anything else, she looks young. Her cheeks are still full, the baby fat not yet stripped away by a lifetime of kneeling to the locked tomb. There's acne on her skin. Blood of Eden has taken her clothes and vestments away as well, so the whole of her is bared. A shame, really. As frumpy and bygone as they were, the clothes never did anything wrong. Blood of Eden burned them, probably, those superstitious freaks. Like anything on those threadbare robes could have been dangerous. Not that it's a terrible thing to see her nude. Even in the relaxing sleep of death, her body is a marvel. The soft bulge of her biceps, visible even without any flex. The firm plane of her abdomen, interrupted only by a great gash whose bloodless edge exposes just a bit of her pretty pink meat. The soft, curling hair that sprawls between her thighs. It matches the fire of her hair. It's curling over her ears now, just a shade longer than it was when she arrived at Canaan House, entangled. When Blood of Eden stripped her and cleaned her, they didn't do it with enough care to brush her hair. They just wanted to get the grime off her, wash away any curse of Ninth House soil. The corpse occupies a peculiar space amongst the devoted Edenites. They want her, but they don't want to touch her. They're scared of her, in ways wholly separate from her status as an unrotting zombie carcass. They whisper about her hair and the line of her nose, the shape of her jaw. None of them want to say it outright, but the rumor spread fast enough regardless. Some great, long-dead commander, revived and then killed again in the shape of this girl. You don't mind touching her, though, and though their disgust of you does not soften, they are grateful for your hands. It makes you laugh, almost. There's humor in it. The great, gorgeous crown princess of Ida, demoted to a common laborer. No more useful than a construct. Blood of Eden doesn't have constructs, though, and you hang on to your usefulness with pointed teeth. On some days, it seems like it's the only leverage you have. They run all sorts of experiments with her. It's sad to watch, honestly. She doesn't deserve this. She probably spent her life praying, or wandering around in penitential silence, and after death, she doesn't even get any sort of party. They sink her in rivers and bury her under mud, leave her out for the animals and the insects and the bacterial rot that never seems to take her. She's heavy. At first it strains you, just a bit, but your body quickly learns. You have always been strong, and unafraid of rigor. Soon her weight becomes easy in your arms. The strangest thing for you, honestly, the biggest culture shock, is that Blood of Eden holds such innate fear of the dead. You have never been bothered by bodies, and could never dream of having the sheer disgust that Blood of Eden shows any type of corpse. You simply never had the option of revulsion. Your necromantic training started early, if one could call it that, when you would have to kneel for hours running your hands uselessly over some corpse, or worse, a pile of bones. All while your sister sweat and bled beside you. It was mostly boring, honestly. Sometimes it was meditative, when the lights were low and your sister hummed quietly, but mostly you just ran your hands over the bodies and looked. Oh, you looked. They really were beautiful. All of them. Each and every one. Your sister never really understood this particular proclivity of yours, but she was always exhausted by the end of any training session, and hypovolemic shock can make for some nasty tempers. You never took it personally when you were the one she chose to rage against. The Ninth Cavalier is beautiful, too. Even the ugly, bloodless wounds that rip her throat and chest and stomach have some amount of grandeur to them. Battle wounds, and from a lictor. How the heroes of your old bedtime stories would rush to weep at her feet. When you do get any time alone with her, after you've convinced Blood of Eden that you truly aren't capable of magicking her up into a zombie soldier, you like to talk to her. She looks far too dead to ever be mistaken for truly sleeping, but she still seems so peaceful, and you wonder aloud if she's ever gotten this kind of rest in her life. She couldn't have been indolent, even on a planet famed for its quiet, peaceful calm. Not with her body. Not with those muscles. Grown so gorgeous, even under the starvation conditions that you know the Ninth House suffers. You like feeling them. Her muscles. Her skin and fat and bone, slippery and cold against your hands. Often when you're pulling her out of whatever muddy grave Blood of Eden has unsuccessfully interred her in, she threatens to slip through your fingers if you don't hold her with all your might, her back flushed to your chest. Your chin rests on top of her head, and her hair tickles your nose. The firm, easy pressure of her dead weight on you is grounding. It's just been so stressful, so enormously terrible, and you miss the familiar weight of another in your bed. You miss the touch that used to come so easy and often in your life. Blood of Eden doesn't allow you to touch the living. Not even Hecht or Jody. Once, you tried to stroke Jody's hand after a fit of coughing, and they shocked you so hard you spent 3 days in the infirmary. But they let you touch the body. It's so interesting, really, once you've gotten over your initial awe at her incorruptibility. You couldn't truly sense a theorem if you tried, but the more time you spend with her, the more you're sure that none of the telltale marks of necromantic touch are there. No runes or blood wards, despite all the time the new lictor spent sobbing over her corpse. And she's still floppy, like rigor never set in, like she was frozen the instant her soul was ripped from her chest. You aren't lacking in knowledge of necromantic theory, and it does hurt you terribly to think of your abandonment, but you wish you had your sister to hypothesize with. She was always so good at following your line of thinking, and could always be needled into putting your theories into practice. Without your other half, though, you can only guess that maybe this is the other half of the electoral equation. The necromancer achieves a perfect life, and their battery, the perfect death. You think about how you could move her, if Blood of Eden left you alone with her for long enough. How you could bend and twist her limbs, and those thick, beautiful fingers. You also think, a bit, about Babs, and his poor broken doll of a body abandoned at Canaan House. You curse him in the silence of your mind, because if this is truly the fate of the Lictorial Cavalier, you hate Yantha more for not granting you this. You would have made such a beautiful corpse, and you did your hair the morning that he died and Yantha ate him. You would have looked perfect forever. The weeks blend into months, a mix of prison cells and dying planets and trying to save the lives of the only people you have left to care about. And as time passes, Blood of Eden starts relying on you more. They become less afraid, if no more trusting. They start leaving you alone with her. At first, it is only for brief moments. They send you with one guard instead of three, and there's only so many places a single human can be at once. Only so many directions a single human can look. They'll stand watch as you sling her body onto the riverbank, and they'll look away long enough for you to indulge yourself. It starts with nothing more than touch. You let your hand on her back linger a moment too long. You let your fingers slide a little closer in between her thighs when you heave her body up the bank. You brush your lips against her forehead, kiss her fingers, comb her hair back from her face, and let your cheek brush against hers. It's good, touching her like this. It's almost enough to sate you for the first few weeks. But soon, you are aching for more. It's a strange, burning need. You can't think about anything else. Your time comes, finally, when they allow you to stay inside the depressing little closet they keep her in between bouts of attempting to make her rot. You've become, not friends, with the guards tasked with keeping track of her, but maybe colleagues. You ask if you can brush her hair. They say yes. It's probably misplaced affection for the lost commander that shares her hair, but you couldn't give a shit why, as long as you get what you want. You wait for the door to close. You wait to hear the guard settle themselves outside. You lean back against the door and sigh. And then you return your attention to the body. You have to fist your hand in your mouth just looking at her, because a laugh has bubbled up in your chest, bright blooming. You don't remember the last time you laughed. You shake yourself. You don't have forever. She's just so gorgeous, even laid out as she is on their makeshift gurney. You step closer. She's cold, of course, when you lay your palm flat against the ruin of her sternum, and your mouth waters when you dip your head to meet hers. As much as you can't bear to wait, there is a ritual to it all. A courtship. You start by murmuring quiet praise into her lips before you kiss her cool, dead mouth, and imagine her kissing you back. Her jaw is slack, and you only need to pry with a touch of force to open her jaw and stick your tongue down her waiting throat. It's good. It's everything you imagined, and when you're done, you let your lips wander lower, down to the skin of her neck and throat. When you dip your tongue into the wound there, it tastes like iron and dirt, and the blood burns up on your tongue with the tang of citrus. You lick over it in a broad stripe, chew a little on the sides. The skin is rubbery between your teeth and does not tear, no matter how much force you put into your bite. Eventually, your devotion must go lower, but you let yourself savor the journey down. You allow yourself to run your hands over her arms, squeeze the soft flesh of her breasts, and roll a nipple between your teeth. You allow yourself to card your fingers through the soft, curling hair that starts at her navel and spreads out over her thighs. You marvel at the texture, how even after months of neglect and abuse, the corpse of Gideon Nav is still as inviting as it ever was. You make sure to pay reverence to her injuries, too. You lick into the great puncture wound in her chest, feel the way her shattered ribs catch against your tongue, almost sharp enough to make you bleed. You think about pressing down harder, and the bright bloom of blood that would surely follow, but you don't want the heady taste of death to be overridden by your living body. It's enough, for now, for you to be gentle with her. By the time you spread her heavy, dead legs, you can feel your own slick between your thighs. You're positively dripping, and you're not sure how you're going to explain the situation to your guard when you inevitably have to ask for a new pair of trousers. You long to touch yourself, but you're nothing if not polite, and you learned your manners well. Your lover comes first. In between the corpse's thighs, her cunt is pink and beautiful. Dry, too, and delicate. Probably unfucked, a possibility that makes you grow even wetter. Entering her is, well, it's messy, honestly. She can't take your fingers until you spit on them, suck down into your throat and coat them in saliva. You work into her carefully, not wanting to damage her, even though at this point you're not sure you even could. But even with the spit and your careful patience, she doesn't want to open for you. You manage to get one finger in, and about half of a second, working in and out as your teeth graze the plush fat around her clit. You think about her head tipping back, her mouth opening, the cute little gasps she would make, if she was alive. The way she'd probably squirm and press up into you, cheeks flushed red. That's a nice thought, but you never did like fucking virgins. All that cuteness wore off after the first half hour, and you hated having to hold any lover's hand through the process. The ninth cavalier especially. She seems like the type to whine. There's a line between cute and just pathetic, and even unfucked, she was well over it. You decide you do rather prefer her dead and cold. Your second finger really doesn't want to go in, but making her take your fist isn't really what you care about anyway. 1.5 fingers are enough, and it's not like she wouldn't have come from one press of your tongue against her clit. You do give it one last kiss, though, for posterity. Your duty satisfied, you finally allow your trousers to drop to the floor. They settle around your ankles, and you think about unlacing your boots so you can pull them all the way off, but you somewhat like the feeling of restraint, and besides, you don't have the time. You can practically hear yourself dripping as you pull yourself on top of the gurney to mount her. The metal squeaks a bit as it takes your weight and you freeze, waiting to hear a shuffle from outside, your guard grown wise and impatient. But there is nothing. You take it as a blessing and straddle her dead form. With reverence, you finally allow her to touch you. You hold her hand, curl her fingers, bend her wrist back and forth just to test the motion. It's functional enough for what you need, and miles better than any cold, stiff corpse you've fucked before. With a sigh, you pull her cool hand between your two bodies. You supinate her palm, curl her first two digits, and insert them inside yourself with no small amount of struggle. Not on your part. You would have no problem taking a fist, but all the movement and flexibility you marveled at before is working against you now. You decide you do wish she was afflicted with rigor, as you rise and fall on top of her. It's rough, and not wholly unpainful, and you keep losing grip on her fingers. For all intents and purposes, the corpse of the Ninth Cavalier is a bad lay. That's all fine, though. You get passably enough friction, and in any case, it's not any worse than some of your inexperienced, nervous suitors back on Ida. Not worse than any other virgin. And again, better, because this one at least isn't whining. Your insides burn. You let go of the table, use your core to stabilize yourself as you bring your other hand to cover your mouth. You try to work her thumb against your clit, your own wetness working against you as it slips, the digit bending, losing any pinpoint accuracy you may have once hoped for. But still, it's just enough to make you moan. The sound is greatly muffled by your hand. You do it again, and then listen. The guard outside your cell is unmoving. There's just no sound. He might be asleep, even. You should tell Wisafer about the work ethic of her staff, but this won't do. You're suddenly seized by a great feeling of indignation. You're the Crown Princess of Ida, the heir to the Emperor's mouth, and your guard is apparently asleep at the wheel. You pull the fist out of your mouth and moan again as you ride her. Your clit pulses, hard, as you hear the guard outside finally move. You grin as you hear shuffling, and then shouts. The door rattles as they fight against the bar you've used to jam it. One shout becomes two, and your breaths quicken into great heaving gasps as you work the hand you hold in slippery fingers. You come with fear in your veins, collapsing on top of the corpse as the door finally bursts open behind you. It's worth it, honestly. And you come a second time as the guard slams his baton across your cheek. The end.